Senator Mack, Senator Feinstein. It's a great pleasure to have an opportunity to participate in this hearing, which I think is extremely timely. It's particularly nice for me to serve on this panel with my friend and colleague, Rick Klausner. We do live in a very exciting time. This ability to understand our own genetic blueprint, this DNA that we carry inside each of our cells, is a bit of a historic moment. The Human Genome Project, which is now 5 years into a 15-year effort to read that entire sequence, is going extremely well. We're ahead of schedule and under budget, and the expectation, in fact, is that it might be finished a couple of years ahead of time at the rate things are going. The audacious nature of this project allows us to predict that we will have in front of us all 100,000 genes that make up the human blueprint in the next 6 or 7 years, and already they are coming out in great profusion. One of the nice things about this project is you don't have to wait until it's over to use it. It's already being used in many laboratories around the world, and in fact this proliferation of genetic discoveries is largely now dependent upon the Genome Project and the mapping information it has produced. In terms of what that all can be thought of, I thought it might be useful by way of an analogy. If each gene is thought of as a book, basically a book like this one that you might pull down from the shelf and flip through the pages, all you would see on those pages would be monotonous strings of A, C, G, and T, because DNA is like that. It's a very simple language. It has only 4 letters in its alphabet, and it's that arrangement of A, C, G, and T that carries all of its information capacity, which is really rather remarkable. So you'd have about 100,000 books like this, each one of which, if you flipped through its pages, would have a lot of letters. You mentioned, Senator Mack, BRCA1 has about 5,000 letters. Well, that's the part of the gene that actually is used to make protein, but then there's a lot of junk in there too. So actually the whole gene from end to end is more like 100,000 letters, so it would be about the size of this. So imagine this whole room filled with shelves, floor to ceiling, about 100,000 volumes. That's what it would take. That is the information that is carried around inside each cell of the body. Now, most of your cells are doing pretty well. They may have inherited some misspellings in a volume or two on the shelf, but they're coping for that. Cancer comes about, basically, because of an accumulation of misspellings in several volumes in particular genes that are involved in regulating the control of cell division, so that cells continue to grow when they really ought to stop. We had a conversation a few minutes ago about the business of cancer. Is it hereditary? If it's genetic, what does that mean? Does that mean it's always hereditary? Maybe I could try to clarify that just very briefly. Cancer is a genetic disease. That's what Rick has already spoken to you about. That means that a cell becomes cancerous because of mutations in DNA. But most of those you're not born with. Most of those come about in a particular cell that makes a mistake when it's copying its DNA. And then that mistake leads to a gene that misbehaves. However, some people with hereditary cancer syndromes are born already with a gene that has a misspelling in it. It's the accumulation on top of that hereditary predisposition of other acquired misspellings
One
that
quick
causes
question.
The problem.
To follow you, some of these answers are important. How does a cell copy DNA?
DNA is this elegant double helix. You've seen pictures of it. And it's the rungs on the ladder of this double helix that actually contain the information. When a cell gets ready to divide, that double helix unwinds, and each strand is used to make a new strand. So you end up with 2 double helixes that have the same sequence, supposedly, as what you started with. But if you make a mistake, then one of those has a new sequence that oftentimes has no significance, but if it's in the wrong place, it's capable of causing that new daughter cell to grow in ways that it shouldn't, and that's the beginnings of cancer.
So it's a placement?
It's often a letter that's wrong, a G instead of an A, a C that should have been a T. That's a mutation, a misspelling. That's what the damage to DNA usually looks like. Now, let me come back to BRCA1, because the significance of this discovery that was announced yesterday, I think, is best understood, again, if we think about this book. So here's the BRCA1 gene, all printed out here inside here. And if I flip through these pages, it's just A's, C's, G's, and T's, page after page. Now, if I wanted to take DNA from someone, and find out whether they have a mutation in BRCA1, as we estimate about 1 in 500 men and women do. Technically, that would be very tough. I would have to read every page, every line, every letter. And only if I did that could I say, there's nothing wrong here. What was announced yesterday was that in one particular population, the Ashkenazi Jewish population, there is one particular misspelling. Let's say right here on page 9, line 31, letters 7 and 8, that are missing. An A and a G that should be there is deleted. Now, that's much easier to find. You don't have to read the whole book. You just turn to that page and look. In technical terms, a high school student practically could do this with a little guidance in an afternoon. It is not a difficult problem to do that kind of mutation detection. Whereas, reading through the whole book, as one would have to do in other populations, as one would have to do for the AT gene, which has its own book, which is also pretty big, which has lots of possible misspellings, has been technically not possible. So that has been a bit of a barrier towards the idea of offering DNA testing to large numbers of people. We just technically haven't been able to do it, although methods are coming along rapidly to figure out how to do that. They do not currently exist. However, now, the significance of this development yesterday is that, at least theoretically, for this one specific population, the Jewish population, it would be theoretically possible to offer that kind of test. Now, should we do so? That's what I want to talk about. This whole business of DNA testing, sort of the pluses and the minuses. Now, let me say from the outset, I am a big fan of DNA testing. I'm a physician. I got into genetics because I thought it was intellectually satisfying. It sort of makes a lot of sense, this information, digital code that you can figure things out from. But as a physician, going to the clinic, treating patients and families with genetic diseases, like Brad Margus, whose very poignant story one hears over and over again with different disease names attached to it in genetics clinics, you get very frustrated because oftentimes there's not much presently you have to offer. And I felt we've got to do better than that. And that is, in fact, a motivation for getting into this business of the Genome Project and trying to figure all this out. So I really want this information to work, and I want it to be useful. And I believe that DNA testing for conditions where early diagnosis can be life-saving, and that's a lot of cancer, is going to be very useful. If I knew that I was at high risk for colon cancer, I would be more likely to go out there and get that colonoscopy once a year than I would be if I just sort of thought I was at average risk. That kind of argument, moving into a new brand of preventive medicine where you take your own individual susceptibility and design a program of surveillance in order to practice early detection, that makes a lot of sense. And I am really looking forward to that era coming in. That being said, I also think that DNA information is very powerful. You might want to think of DNA testing in that sense the same way as you think of the development of a new drug. Drugs have efficacy, that is, they work, but they have toxicities. DNA tests are the same. DNA tests can give you life-saving information in some circumstances, but if the test is given to you in a way that you can't understand because you didn't have the education and counseling that should have gone with it, or if the test is dropped in your lap and you're presented with options, really none of which are going to benefit you, or if that test result is used against you because the next day you've lost your health insurance, then you've suffered a toxic consequence. What we are really talking about here today, I think, is how to increase the benefits and decrease the risks, and that's what I want to focus my comments on. Sophocles has a wonderful quote that I'm very fond of, and it comes from a story of a particular individual in this myth who was doomed to be able to see the future but not change it. And that person is quoted as saying, "It is but sorrow to be wise when wisdom profits not." I think many people would take that same approach to a genetic test that allows you to peer into the crystal ball but not be able to reach in there and change anything. The kinds of tests people want are those where they can use that information to reduce their risk or that of their families. And that's the kind that I think we should be putting a lot of effort on. And that those tests are coming along. Again, I don't wish to be negative here. I'm actually very positive. But one has to think about that. Do you want to know? Do you want to know information about which nothing can be done? Or are you really interested in those things where something can be done?
I think we've been kind of running this informally this morning, so if you don't mind, that is a question that comes to my mind. In this area that you've just focused on, it sounds like many would be comfortable, let's say, with respect to breast cancer, BRCA1, coming up with a test and saying that this is for families that we consider to be high risk. In other words, you kind of set some parameters. But it sounds like others are saying we're uncomfortable, in essence, saying that that test ought to be made available to the general population. Question really comes in, if you develop the test and the procedures, do you deny someone who wants to avail themselves of the test that is not in that high risk population?
Yeah, I think people are uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable with the idea of a big brother sort of attitude towards genetic testing, that it's not available because somebody thinks it's not good for you. On the other hand, I think people are looking for guidance. Just as, again, to use the drug analogy, we don't have a system where people can walk into the store and order chemotherapy because they think maybe they've got cancer even though they haven't been diagnosed. We think that's dangerous because there's toxicities there that you wouldn't want people to suffer, and we believe that there needs to be some way of regulating, overseeing how that kind of new information is introduced into medical practice. As I will describe in a minute, I think we do have that system now in place with a task force on genetic testing that I want to tell you about. But I agree this is a very significant issue, and we need the right experts looking at it. All the stakeholders in this business, including especially consumers, if we're going to get into that phase where genetic tests find their way into medical practice in a responsible and effective way. There has been a negative experience with genetic testing that I think influences at least some of us, and that is the history of sickle cell testing back in the 1970s. Very well-intentioned programs in many states were put in place to offer and in some cases mandate sickle cell carrier testing for African Americans. People were tested without a really clear explanation of what the test was about. The carriers, which are very frequent in the black population, about 10%, were not always told what it meant to be a carrier. Many of them believed they were going to become ill, which is not true for a sickle cell carrier. Some of them lost their health insurance because their health insurance agents thought they were going to become ill too and canceled their policy. Some damage was done by a well-intentioned but not well-thought-through effort to integrate genetics into care. I don't want to see that experience repeated. In fact, I think this technology is so powerful and so useful that we have a particularly strong obligation to do it right and not sort of screw it up in the first attempt so that the public becomes turned off and says, ooh, that stuff, I don't want that. I read in the pages of Newsweek that this person had that test and something bad happened. And we might lose 20 years if we do it wrong at the outset. The Human Genome Project, recognizing that the ethical, legal, and social implications of this set of advances in genetic research are as important as the science, has set up this ELSI program. It's called ELSI, for Ethical, Legal, and Social Implications. And we invest 5% of our budget on that, making this the largest investment in ethical research in the history of the planet. And I think that has been a wonderful experiment and is turning out to be a very successful one. That is partly a research portfolio to get better answers to some of these questions, and it's partly a more policy-oriented effort through the so-called ELSI Working Group, which is a group of experts from various walks of life, ethicists, public citizens, consumers, lawyers, scientists, who have been gathering on a very regular basis to try to make recommendations about what we need to do in order to protect people against the possibility of this genetic information being misused. The major emphasis areas for the ELSI Working Group include the following: ethical issues in genetic research, particularly informed consent; responsible clinical integration of new genetic testing — that's what we're talking about primarily this morning, and I want to explain a little more what we're doing there — privacy and fair use of genetic information, that is, the avoidance of discrimination. I also want to say something about that. And fourthly, professional and public education, which Dr. Klausner has already alluded to, is a very high priority, especially for the medical profession, which largely has had little exposure to genetics and is ill-prepared in many ways for this development where genetics becomes a central part of the actual practice of medicine. Now, let me just tell you about three parts of that ELSI effort that I think are particularly relevant for today's discussion. One is the business of trying to figure out as a research effort how to begin to initiate testing for cancer susceptibility as BRCA1 and the colon cancer genes represent. Together with the Cancer Institute and the Nursing Institute and the Mental Health Institute, we began funding a year ago a series of 11 groups who are working together as a consortium, the Cancer Studies Consortium, to investigate how this goes when you bring in individuals who are at high risk because of a strong family history of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, or colon cancer, educate them about what DNA testing and what it is and what it isn't, and then offer them the test for these genes, BRCA1 and the colon cancer genes, and then counsel them about the outcome, studying very carefully all along the way what works and what doesn't. Dr. Karen Lerman, who is in the third panel, is a member of that consortium, and she will tell you more about it. I think it has been a very useful experience. A second thing I want to tell you about is this task force on genetic testing. This group, which is actually a spin-off from the ELSI working group and is chaired by Dr. Tony Holtzman of Johns Hopkins, has the very ambitious but very important mission of addressing all of these questions about the timing of introduction of new genetic tests, about issues of quality control in laboratories so that you know when you get a test back that you can trust the result, and about education as well so that medical practice is ready for this. This task force has representation from the private sector, from companies that are offering the testing. It has representation from professional geneticists, from consumers, and it has liaisons to the government agencies like FDA and CDC and HICVA and AHCPR that are interested in the business of bringing this kind of testing into medical practice. That group has been meeting since April. They've broken up into three subcommittees. Their first set of draft recommendations will be discussed at a public meeting in November. And I believe this is the right mix of points of view and expertise to come forward with the kinds of general guidelines, not just one gene at a time, not just today's event or yesterday's event, but a series of general guidelines that will help us learn how to bring these things into medical practice in a responsible way. The third area that I wanted to focus on is the business of the fair use of genetic information. And here I would particularly like to bring to your attention because I believe there is a need for federal legislative intervention, and that's not just my opinion. That is the opinion of a very responsible and effective group of people that have been meeting to discuss this. We had a meeting in July, in fact, which was jointly sponsored by the ELSI Working Group and the National Action Plan on Breast Cancer. The National Action Plan is a public-private partnership, which is partly federal agencies that are working in breast cancer research and partly consumers, and most notably the National Breast Cancer Coalition. That group has identified genetic discrimination in health insurance as a very high priority, and that was the impetus for holding this meeting. This was a powerful meeting. We began the meeting on July 11th with presentations by two members of a family from Michigan who have a mutation in the BRCA1 gene. Both of these women carry that mutation. One of them has already had cancer. The other decided to take the drastic step of prophylactic mastectomy to try to reduce her risk. The most powerful part of their presentation to me was that they were unable to use their own names. They both only agreed to come under the circumstances that they could use an assumed name and there would be no photographs taken during the workshop. And why was that? You might wonder. To protect their families, perhaps? No. Their families know what's going on. It was because of their fear that they would lose their health insurance if it became known that they had this genetic situation. That is not unique to them.
Are there other instances other than, sickle cell, where insurance companies have actually canceled people based on a DNA or based on a genetic profile?
Absolutely. Paul Billings in California has been collecting instances of this sort. He's published a paper a couple of years ago that documented more than 100 cases. A recent survey done by the Alliance of Genetic Support Groups and Georgetown University of individuals who are in families where genetic disease has been diagnosed, 31% of them said that they had been denied coverage for a particular medical procedure. And many of those people were not actually ill, but there was a concern that they would become ill.
Did we get copies of those studies?
Yes. Please? Yes. I think this is not a theoretical once-in-a-while occasion. I don't know if you saw 10 days ago the New York Times Magazine, this cover story called Living with Toxic Knowledge. The writer here has a father who died of a heart condition, which is hereditary, and he was trying to decide whether he wanted to know his own status. Very poignant sort of final chapter to this. He goes out to Iowa to visit with a family that has had the same heart condition, and as he's walking to the car to say goodbye, the young man who has the condition says to him, "You know, I do hope you will honor our request not to use our names. Everybody else in this family has lost their insurance, including me, but I still have hopes for my kids." Mm. That's very poignant, and that's not an isolated experience.
Do you know, I think you mentioned 100 such cases and 31% had lost their insurance. How did the information get to the insurance companies?
In many instances, simply by the fact that insurance companies have access to medical records, physicians send them the medical records of that individual as part of the process of writing up the insurance. If you think that our medical records are private and people don't get access to them without the patient's approval, that isn't really the way the system works. And we do have a problem there with medical records, privacy of all sorts.
Are you saying that any time if we were to go in to get in and take out an insurance policy, our medical records are sent to the insurance company?
You are usually asked your permission for that, but that is part of the process. If it's an individual policy, you should probably pose these questions to Mr. Raymond, but my understanding is yes.
You have? I've never have, huh?
Yeah, insurance, health insurance for individuals depends upon having that information. That's called underwriting, and I want to say something about that. I'm not here to try to destroy the insurance industry. Mr. Raymond is probably worried that I am. I'm not at all. I understand the realities here. Insurance is a business. You can't expect insurance companies to hand money over for no good reason. What I am here to argue is that genetic information ought to be taken off the table. If it's off the table for everybody, then you're spreading the risk, and that probably is a more acceptable way to do it. I think what many companies are worried about is that it'll be off the table for them, but somebody else will be using it, and they'll end up with all the people with the high risk, the so-called adverse selection picture, which worries insurance agents a lot, and I understand that. And by the way, let me say, the arguments I have here are related to health insurance. Disability insurance and life insurance, I think, are much different matters. But our current health insurance system is both unjust and unworkable. It's unworkable because we all, as Brad Margus told us, have mistakes in our DNA. And through the Genome Project and these advances, which are occurring very rapidly, we're going to find out what they are and who will be left insurable.
And again, based on that point that all of us have genetic mistakes and they're constantly occurring, some will lead to a disease, others will not.
Some of those
changes will take place in one person, which would lead to a disease. The same changes could take place in someone else and not lead to the disease.
That's right.
So what you're saying is that what could happen is that companies could take the information that is available today, draw conclusions about it that are totally false.
Could be. I mean, these will be statistical risks which will change as we get more information.
And only those of us who would be identified possibly as carrying a gene that we know about will pay a price. The ones that are carrying a defect, let's say, that are unknown today would not be.
That's right. Although their health may be in the future no better than those who find out. So it's a system that becomes a bit illogical, and that's the other argument. I mean, there's the moral argument as well, that you don't get to pick your genes. No, none of us got to select what our DNA sequences were going to be, so they shouldn't be used against you. That seems to fly in the face of usual concepts of justice.